I think I'm probably the friendliest bike rider out there.
It's very good to see, because there's a lot of cycling clubs that don't even wave back. So
no,
well done.
I'm a waver. I always get a bit upset if somebody doesn't wave
it's
back.
It's really bad.
Fine.
You are listening to Service Course by the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. The stories behind the bikes.
We really are so used to seeing men as the default that most people aren't aware that they are ignoring women.
There are some things that, like, currently I'm really frustrated about, and it's exactly that it's based on men and not women.
With Tom Worley and Lizzie Banks.
Well, this is rather nice, isn't it?
Yeah, this is the most glorious day, probably the last glorious day we're going to have this year, if I'm honest.
That voice is Lizzie Banks. Lizzie, where have you brought me today on our ride?
So I've brought you to my favourite spot in the Peak District, and I probably shouldn't have brought you here on a podcasting day, because I'm going to tell everybody about it and then they're all going to flock here. We're actually at the top of Abney. We're just outside the gliding club, and it is a spectacular day. There's not a cloud in the sky, beautiful blue skies, and we just watched a glider go off. And it just shot into the air, and oh, it's magical.
You were very excited. The gliders, they're amazing, actually. They climb so steeply, don't they? And there's a cable attached which drops off on a parachute. It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing. And there was another one above it, and then there was a proper aeroplane much further up, and it kind of looked like it was going to crash into it. But yeah, coming up here and watching the gliders, it's one of my favourite things to do on a ride, and procrastinating before I have to do my efforts.
Well, I was going to start this show. We've got a lot to talk about in this show. I was going to start it by talking about the World Championships, but I think maybe we'll just have a... It was not the greatest day, basically.
Oh, well, it was a great day, you know. I've never experienced a presentation like it, crowds like it, but unfortunately for me, it personally wasn't my day. I was blighted by mechanicals, and it's one of those things, so I think I'm just going to try and draw a line under it and put it behind me and take away the positive aspects from the day and the great week that I had with British Cycling and the support that I had from the GB team and getting to know the team, which it was a great week, but unfortunately it didn't end quite the way we wanted it to. We didn't take home a rainbow jersey. Maybe next year.
Well, I do want to talk about one of the positives, actually, because I missed the race. I was in London, but I did see the clip that the UCI shared of the peloton riding into Otley, and you had the privilege of leading Lizzie Deignan through Otley.
Yeah, what a special moment.
I'm going to play a clip of it now, actually. We can hear it in the background.
Great. Yeah, so Lizzie came to the front and I just came round to protect her. And then I kind of thought, oh, yeah, we're in Otley. And she said, lead me out through Otley. And, oh, what an amazing moment. You know, the crowds were kind of 10 deep all the way through Otley. And at the end, she came round and passed each other on the shoulder. And it was just a spine-tingling moment, something that's never going to happen again in my career.
As a way of sort of introducing you to our listeners, I mean, a lot of our listeners will know you already, thanks to the audio diary that you kept for us at the Giro Rosa. If you haven't heard it, then you should definitely sign up as a friend of the podcast, as you can listen to that, and it gets you access to loads more brilliant programmes like it. Lizzie, do you mind if I play a quick clip from the diary?
Yeah, go for it.
Do you know which clip I'm going to play?
I think it might be stage 8. That was quite a good day for the team.
But I've never suffered like I suffered today. And I knew that the gap back to the breakaway group was only 20 seconds. And I got to 3K to go and it was still only 20 seconds. And I thought, oh, shit, I'm going to get caught on the line. And it's all going to be for nothing. But I never gave up. And then it started raining and I was like, yeah, I can do this.
We can ride in the rain. Both Lizzie and I like the rain.
So yeah, at 1K to go, Thomas finally said 30 seconds on the radio, but you can never trust a gap as well. So yeah, I was just in so much pain. It's unbelievable. And I kept pushing right to the line and I looked back and I just couldn't believe that there was nobody there.
So we're still sat up here in the hills on Abney in the Peak District. Lizzie, actually, what behind us, what can we see? There's pretty some pretty special landmarks around here as well.
Yeah, so right behind us we've got a clear view of the whole of Stanage Edge,
which is where there's some world-class climbing, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, I think I'm right in saying it's the longest crag in the whole of Europe. I hope I've got my facts right there.
That sounds about right. I'm sure I've heard that before.
But yeah, it's definitely one of the most popular gritstone edges in the whole of the UK. Climbers flock here because it's awesome. You can also see Burbage Edge. Surprise view is just hidden. keeping it a nice surprise. And then you can see the top of Sir William Hill, which is a nice place to go if you like hill climbs, not a nice place to go if you don't. We're just near to Eam, which is famous for having the plague. But yeah, it's absolutely beautiful around here. There's so much great riding. If you want somewhere to ride and just get away from it all, then come up to the Peak District.
I mean, and also, like yourself, there are quite a lot of pro riders based in this part of the world as well, aren't there?
Yeah, there's a lot of male pros. Annie Last, the mountain biker, also lives really close to here. I think she might be based in Sheffield or maybe Matlock, I'm not sure. She's pretty close. Some historical pros as well. Penny Rowson was from here. Yeah, that. Ben Swift is Doncaster,
not
I think.
Far, yeah.
The Downings are close. Yeah, loads of people. It's a great place to train. Come here and you'll be a pro before you know it.
I mean, I have attempted to claim that this is the Girona of the North. I'm not sure if that's stuck yet.
I think our weather is slightly less good, but the hills are just as good.
So anyway, so this is Service Course. I mean, obviously, we've been chatting about where we are and what we've been up to, but this is ostensibly a show about cycling tech. And this month's episode, well, it was inspired by a book I've been reading. Lizzie, you've not had time to read the book, but I did send you a podcast interview with the author. The book is Invisible Women. It's by Caroline Criado Perez. And basically, the thesis of the book is that there is inherent data bias around the world in favour of men, and that manifests itself in the way the world is designed in favour of men. And having read the book, I thought, well, I wonder if it's if that's apparent in cycling too. But here's, I mean, just to get you a flavour of it, here's Caroline speaking to the excellent 99% Invisible podcast. I urge you to track down this episode if you can, but also if you get a chance, just listen to as much of that show as you can, because it's always excellent.
And so we really are so used to seeing men as the default, that most people aren't aware that they are ignoring women. But for people who are developing tech, for people who are developing workplace policy, for people who are developing medical research, you know, I wrote this book to kind of try and wake those people up, because I don't think that they are bad people, but by not collecting sex disaggregated data, what they are doing is having really serious, negative, potentially fatal results for women.
So from the same programme, this is an example of how male data bias translates into design and impacts on women. And it's staggering, and it really brings home the point that Caroline is trying to make in the book.
The car crash test dummy that has been used for decades to test car safety has been based on a 50th percentile male.
Wow.
And obviously that is a problem. You know, female bodies differ from male bodies in all sorts of ways. I mean, we have fewer neck muscles, we have less upper body muscle mass, our spinal columns are different, our pelvises are different, you know. So these are all issues that need to be taken into account. But we've got this 50th percentile male dummy, as if, of course, the 50th percentile male is the 50th percentile human. And actually, what is quite enraging, really, is that when this was introduced in the 1950s, there was actually a debate about having a female crash test dummy. But as happens so often, car manufacturers lobbied against it on the basis that it would be too expensive.
The fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Lizzie, I sent you the clip of that programme, and obviously we want to relate this back to cycling. But after listening to it, did you have any sort of specific thoughts about what Caroline was saying and what she'd been writing about?
It was an incredibly interesting podcast, and it brings to light so many things that you would just never think would be an issue. And like Tom was saying earlier, I really urge you to go and listen to it. And it kind of opens your eyes to data bias. And one thing that was really interesting for me was she was talking about how in Sweden they found that if they cleared the roads in a different way, it actually hugely reduced hospital admissions.
So what they were doing, they were clearing the roads, basically the main roads they were clearing first, and then doing the sort of minor roads, weren't they?
Yeah, and they decided that, or they realised that male and female patterns of movement were so different that if they changed the road clearing to actually clear the female movement patterns first and then the males, then females were more likely to be walking than males. And it meant that females were then less likely to trip over, less likely to have hospital admissions. And they saved three times the amount of money on hospital admissions than they actually used repairing the roads So it was just mind-blowing how this can have a huge impact on our economy. And it's something that you would never even think to think about. And so we need to be encouraged to think about this disaggregated gender data and think about it in situations where you might not, it might not occur to you that it's relevant, but actually it's always relevant.
Well, this is why it's great to talk to you about it, because obviously I am a straight, able-bodied, white male, and essentially the world is pretty much built for me. So I can walk around being totally oblivious to this sort of stuff. But in terms of cycling, we are going to get onto it in terms of cycling. I'm going to have there's a fascinating interview with Ashley Moorman-Passio I'm going to about to play you. But in terms of the way bikes are designed, have you noticed that bike design women tend to be a bit of an afterthought in bike design, in any aspect of it, you know, kit or bikes themselves?
Yeah, I think it's actually interesting because I've only ever ridden bikes that are built for men. Or should I say, I've never ridden a women's specific frame.
Well, actually, I'm going to ask you about that. So what is a women's specific frame? I've never really understood why they are different.
So it's a frame where the geometry is built for a woman, rather than building your bike for a man, your average man, and then scaling it down to fit a woman. They build it around the size of a woman. You know, you might have, if you've got an XXS bike, you might need 650B wheels, and you'd never find that on a men's bike. But, you know, Emma Pooley rode the Olympics on 650B wheels. So it is something that people require and people need, and especially smaller riders.
At your level of the sport in the World Tour, does anyone use 650B at all?
I don't think so. I was thinking about this the other day, and I don't think so, because you probably have so many problems with interchangeability. And so, you know, already in the peloton, we have a mixture of disc brakes and rim brakes, and you also have different standards with disc brakes. So it brings about problems with neutral service and also even with wheels within teams. If you've got half the team on, or one person in the team on 650Bs, and you jump out of the car and then you've got to take two sets of wheels with you, I think it would make life quite difficult for the mechanics
Well, you've only ever ridden a men's frame. Why is that?
Well, I'm a 51-52. And just the bikes that I've had through my team or the bikes that I bought when I was first starting out, they were just the ones that I came across. So when I first started, it was just, there weren't any women-specific bikes out there, to be honest. I think Canyon was probably the only company making them really at that point. Actually, Liv were beginning to make them. It didn't occur to me, you know, that there wasn't the option. They were more expensive. They were prohibitively expensive. And I'm a relatively tall woman. So for me, I found that it was the right kind of size. I didn't need to look for one.
It's a nice motorbike.
It is a nice motorbike. Get us up the hills a little bit faster than we've been going up them. Yeah, so I think now, if I were to go out and buy my own bike, it's definitely something I would look into. But obviously, being on a team, you're restricted in some ways. But I mean, I ride what is essentially a male frame, but I love it. You know, I've always ridden a male frame, and for me, it works perfectly, and I love my bike.
Well, we're going to head to a cafe because it's getting a bit chilly out here, even though the sun's out. It is the first day where I've actually had cold ears on a ride today, first day of the year. While we're heading to the cafe, we wanted to find out whether the experience of riders suggested that, like so much of the rest of the world, cycling has an innate design bias in favour of men. I spoke to Ashley Moorman-Passio from Team CCC Live. I asked her if she was surprised to hear that there was any bias at all.
No, it doesn't surprise me at all, because it definitely exists. So, yeah, there are some things that, like, currently I'm really frustrated about. And it's exactly that it's based on men and not women, you know. So even UCI, there's a UCI rule, for example, at the moment that's really, really frustrating for me. And it's certainly based on a male and not a female, you know. Yeah, so for me, I'm at this point, like, really frustrated by the minimum weight rule. So the minimum bicycle weight rule. Number one, it's a totally old-fashioned rule that's been sort of the same for a couple of years now. And it's been kind of spoken about here and there, you know, people are sort of saying, oh, when is this rule going to change? But as a female cyclist, like, it's so obvious that this rule has been based on the average weight of a male. And so the frustration for women, and especially for me being quite a small woman, is that, you know, nowadays, like, our bikes are easily underweight, you know, the smaller bikes, you know. And so the frustration around that is that you have to add so much extra weight to the bike. And again, like, it cannot be visible to the naked eye. So the only place that you really can do it is down the seat tube. So what happens is that all the weight is kind of concentrated in the area sort of your bottom bracket, which is kind of the safest place to put it, because it kind of, you know, it doesn't affect the weight distribution so much of the bike, but it does affect the dynamics of the bike. You know, our smaller bikes are not designed to have 800 grams extra added to the bottom bracket. So it changes how the bike feels, you know. And so I just find it's totally unfair, because this minimum weight of 6.8, I'm pretty certain is based on the average weight of a male cyclist, you know, which, you know, if I just use some of my own logic, I would say they probably have decided, okay, maybe let's call the average weight of a male cyclist 68 kilograms. So the bike needs to be at least 10% of the cyclist's body weight, you know. And so, you know, for a cyclist like myself who weighs 50 kilograms, it's a huge disadvantage. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, up to a minute on a 10K, a really steep 10K climb. That's what this weight disadvantage is costing me. On top of that, like, it just is totally unfair for females, especially smaller females that are weighing, you know, 50, 55 kilograms. Our bikes are always underweight because it's not unsafe. You know, that's how they're being designed by the bike industry, you know. And so that means we're adding sometimes up to 800 grams on our bikes, and it totally changes the feeling of the bike, you know. So when you start climbing outside out of your saddle, you can feel this like dead weight in your bottom bracket, and it's just totally frustrating.
Well, I thought that was quite interesting from Ashley Mormon-Passio.
Yeah, I think it's not something that I've personally had a problem with myself. You know, she's a much, much lighter rider than I am, and she rides a much smaller bike. So as a rider that's at least 10 kilos more than her and rides a couple of frame sizes bigger, I haven't had a problem with meeting the weight limit. So it's really interesting to hear her so passionate about something that I actually haven't had a problem with at all. But I can see why it is really difficult for her. And for sure, adding weight to random parts of your bike can completely change how it feels. Manufacturers make a bike and they really specifically put carbon in different places and strengthen the bike in certain places. And that bike feels a certain way it does when it's made. And then if you go and shove a load of weight in the bottom bracket, then it's going to change the dynamics of the bike. But yeah, I don't really know if we should change the limit or not. Personally, I'm happy with it the way it is. Always think that we should look into rules. We shouldn't just be complacent with the things they are, things how they are. We should always question things and try and move things forward for the good of the sport. But yeah, it's not something I've had a problem with.
So back onto the subject of whether cycling design is biased in favour of men, I spoke with Liz Colebrook. Now, not only is Liz one of the very few women designing and building bike frames, her company is called Beaumont Bicycle, but she also designs bikes for other outliers, as she calls them, and that's people outside of the traditional stereotype that bikes are marketed to and designed for.
So we've come from when you used to measure what the size of the frame was by taking a tape measure from the top of the seat tube down to the middle of the bottom bracket, and we would just give that an inch number, and it was, you know, 19, 19 and a half, 20, all the way up to 25 and a half, that sort of thing. Nowadays, we've kind of gone to sort of T-shirt sizing, and I think Mike Burrows was responsible for that. So a T-shirt sizing is sort of extra small, small, medium, large, extra large. And that actually makes it a lot easier for people. But guess what? It's just your average, pretty young, white, Caucasian male or female. that's what that refers to. So if you're an outlier in terms of age or ethnic background, and you know, you might have had inherited different genes, or anyone really who might have like a longer body, shorter body. So we all vary. Some of us got shorter arms. I mean, I've just built a frame for a guy with achondroplasia, which is otherwise known as dwarfism. So he's actually got kind of normal back length, much shorter leg, much shorter arm, hands not too bad in the finger length. So he's okay with the brakes, but I'm setting them up on full sort of maximum, sort of reducing the reach as much as I possibly can. And that's all working out really well. But that's an example of a real outlier. And we're all around, really.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
So technically, this bike ride that I've been on with Lizzie didn't actually happen. And that's because I wasn't able to upload it to Strava, because as I was coming down the Snake Pass, unfortunately my Garmin mount's a little bit loose. Hit a pothole, Garmin popped out. I turned around to go and find it. I did find it, but it was in two pieces and it's absolutely useless now. So the ride wasn't uploaded. And that's cost me a couple of hundred quid to get a replacement, which wouldn't have happened had I got around sorting out my insurance with Lacker. Lacker is a community-driven bicycle insurer that's a game-changing concept to insure your bike and gear, in which you only share the true cost of damages and thefts with other members of the community. And the idea is that when you make a claim, unlike with other insurers, the actual process of making a claim should be a positive experience. This is co-founder Jens Hartwig talking you through what happens when you make a claim.
So the moment you sign in into our website and basically just submit the claim, upload a video of yourself quickly telling us what happened, telling us where and when. From our side, we are then just really looking, okay, what happened to the bike? Are there any deadlines for you? Are you having a holiday coming up where we really need the bike for? And then we're really looking at like, what is the best solution for you as a member of the community, and what's the best outcome for the community overall? Because we are basically the middleman, so to speak, to get the best outcome for everyone. So let's say, classic example, you crashed on a race, your right shifter and your right rear mech is broken. And now you want to get those replaced. We would usually work with the local shop to get you these parts and get them fitted as fast as possible. On average, that's usually around less than 7 days, and you're back on the road.
To sign up, visit lacker.co.uk. That's Lacker, LAKA.co.uk. Lacker, bicycle insurance powered by the community. Interesting stuff there from Liz. One of the things that really bothers you about bike design, and when it comes to women's design, is the saddle.
Yeah, and it's a really tricky issue. You know, the contact points are so important. Think how many hours you spend with your bum in contact with your saddle. And if that's not right, that can cause somebody to stop cycling. Actually, the very first cycling event that I did was a 100-mile sportive, and I was just on the saddle that came with the bike. I didn't know anything about cycling at the time. I was in shorts and t-shirt and trainers and just having the best time.
This is only about 5 years ago as well, and you're now a World Tour pro.
I think it might have been 6 years ago, but yeah, it wasn't that long ago. But yeah, I didn't know what I was doing, and I actually ended up with a urinary tract infection off the back of this, because I wasn't using cycling shorts, so I just had knickers and shorts on, which wasn't good for bacteria. I had a saddle that didn't fit me, but I didn't really know, so I was getting injuries, to just put it lightly. And yeah, so I developed this urinary tract infection, and after the 100-mile sportive, I actually ended up in hospital with a kidney infection on IV antibiotics. So that shows you how serious it can be to get the right saddle. And that's definitely something that could put someone off cycling for life.
How? I mean, I'm someone who's never really read about a saddle. I've just trial and error found things that I've liked. Is the information out there about what the right saddle is for you? And as a woman, particularly, is there any? You know, when you go, if you go into a bike shop, for instance, is there the expertise there for someone to tell you should be using this saddle?
I don't think so. That's my opinion in you know, the short answer. I don't think there's enough information, but part of it, it's like, yeah, you can have information, but like you said, trial and error is kind of the only way. And you can measure yourself, and you can use, we're supported by Jabeamized in my team, Bigler, and Jabeamized are great. They have pressure mapping, and they supported us with all the different saddles, and unfortunately I just didn't fit any of their saddles, and so they were great that they said it's okay, you can use your own saddle. So I'm really lucky in this situation that I'm able to use a saddle day in, day out, that fits me perfectly, that I don't have problems with. But unfortunately in a previous team I had a situation where I had a saddle sponsor, and they didn't really make, well, they made one saddle for women, but it didn't suit me, and I had problems the whole year.
And as an inexperienced rider, is it difficult to speak up and say, look, this saddle isn't for me? I know it's a sponsor, you're being paid to use it, to ride it. Is it harder for you to speak up and say, I can't work with this?
In that situation, I was a new professional, and I was really concerned about speaking up. I didn't want to cause a fuss. And it actually got to the point where it was so painful, I couldn't pee, that I just had to say something. And I said, you know, I'm really, really struggling. And they said, you've just got to use the saddle. So that was a really difficult situation for me. I actually couldn't use it on my time trial bike. And I love time trialing. And that year, I pretty much just didn't time trial because I simply couldn't sit on the bike. And if I did sit on the bike, there was one session I went out and I was doing 10-minute efforts. And I could only do about 4 minutes. And then I actually ended up bursting into tears, so I was in so much pain. And I just didn't know what to do. So, yeah, it's a difficult thing. There are so many saddles, they're made for men. And then there are some saddles that are thought about for women, but there's so few saddles on the market that are kind of specifically designed for women compared to how many are designed for men. So we have less to choose from. There's not, in my opinion, not very good advice from bike shops. What would be ideal is some bike shops you can, I think, Specialized, I think you can go in and you can maybe trial saddles, which is a really great thing. But yeah, being able to trial a saddle and then come back and say, yes, I want this, or yes, I don't want this, is the best option, really. And that would be like the gold standard for bike shops, to have, you know, 10 different saddles and you can try one, maybe leave a deposit, come back and decide if you want it or not a week later, or even rent it out, you know, for a week for a small fee. That would be a really good thing. And perhaps that would go some way to solving the kind of, yeah, discomfort that many women have on the bike.
I mean, again, you know, we spoke about how the world is designed for men. And again, I walk through the world oblivious to this sort of stuff. You know, for me, a bad saddle might be a little bit of discomfort, a saddle sore change. But the consequences for you as a woman are much more serious, as you said.
I actually disagree. I think the consequences for men are also very serious, and I think that people actually don't realise. A lot of men experience numbness in the perineal area, and that can actually lead to problems with sexual dysfunction later in life. And that's something that's not very often talked about. You know, it's a bit of a taboo topic, or people don't like to talk about it. I've had friends of my husband who've actually contacted me about saddles and said, oh, you know, I've got a bit of numbness. And, you know, I just tackle the issue head on because it's a really, really important issue. If you're getting numbness on the bike, you need to get it sorted out. You need to look into a saddle with a cutout, or a saddle with a bit of a dip in the middle that's going to remove that pressure from your perineal area. And it can be really hard to find the right saddle. And you don't want to go and spend 100 quid on a saddle and 100 quid on another saddle and it's not right and it's not right. But ask around. There are so many people that have had this problem, that especially if you've got a local cycling club or just people in the local cycling community, there are bound to be people that have tried saddles and they just got them, you know, in the cellar or in the workshop, and they're not using them. So ask around and you will find something that works for you eventually.
Well, back to Liz Colebrook. When I was speaking to her, I also wanted to ask her about why there aren't more women in cycling, and particularly designing and building bikes.
You can sort of see why it's quite a kind of high altitude. You're working at high altitude, really. You've got to, behind your knowledge, you've got to have so much you've got to have a sort of a hinterground of knowledge. So mine is all in the componentry. So other frame builders, women like Karen Hartley, her hinterland, whatever you want to call it, is all in jewellery. So this is, for her, a bicycle frame is like big jewellery. So she is very familiar with what the metal's doing, what the whole process of putting it all together. So that's the two main women. We've got Mecrady, we've got Adeline, and her background's actually in the field of riding. So she brings that wealth of knowledge of the geometry that works for her, and then she's just thought, well, I can do this. So she's got on and learnt it. She's a real go get it sort of person. So yeah, you do need to be right out there, and you just got to it's a very pioneering role. It really is. So I feel like a pioneer, and if I've made it easier for any other woman to give it a go, I am just so pleased.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport. I'm going to need all the caffeine gels I can get. I'm going to keep riding around with professionals like Lizzie in the Peak District. If you want to get 25% off your next order from Science in Sport, simply use the offer code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Are there enough women in the cycling industry, Lizzie?
Probably not, no. I think it's something that's kind of ingrained into our culture, really. You know, it's seen as a male-dominated environment, so women are less inclined to go into it. There's less female engineers. Hands-on work is seen as a typically manly job, even though it shouldn't be. And I think it is beginning to change. So perhaps in the future we'll see more women going into the industry. It would be really nice to see more women in the bike industry.
I mean, like for you, obviously, you know, it's very important for you in terms of the equipment that you use, that you can talk to someone, talk to a mechanic and get stuff. I mean, have you ever worked with any female mechanics or in the industry at all?
No, never. No, I don't think there is a female mechanic on the world tour that I know of in the women's peloton. But it's tough. I mean, it's not only the fact that it's seen as a male-dominated environment, it's also a tough job to go into, and traditionally women of a certain age start thinking about having children, and you're away from home a hell of a lot as a professional mechanic. So balancing that, you know, family life, work life thing is really tough, and I can understand why there aren't women in the industry.
Well, it's brought up another interesting issue, that of what she calls outliers in cycling, particularly those with a disability, and how cycling design is or isn't inclusive of them. With that in mind, I spoke to a British cyclist who actually won gold at the recent World Championships in Harrogate.
I'm Ben Watson. I am a male C3 paracyclist on the GB paracycling team, and I'm heading towards Tokyo, which is the main goal for the last 4 years, and it's coming up pretty quickly, and it's less than a year to go. I've had the best season on the road I've ever had. I haven't finished outside of the top five in any World Cup or World Championships. It's gone pretty well. Third in the time trial in Belgium World Cup, followed up by a solo victory in the road race. Then went to Canada. I got second in the time trial behind my teammate, and then fourth in the road race. Had another good World Championship, so third place in the individual time trial. Fifth place in a bunch sprint for the road race. And then finally, we had a great paracycling C1 as part of the Yorkshire 2019 World Championships, ended in Harrogate, and I managed to win that solo. So a great way to bookend the season.
And not bad, you've got the trophy sat on the table in front of us. Is that the biggest thing you've ever won?
Yeah, it really is. It's impressive. Got a really nice bunch of flowers as well, which is still going strong. Lots of Yorkshire roses, so the girlfriend really appreciated that. But that, the trophy is cool. I don't know if you guys have seen them before. You'll have seen them from the rest of the races across the World Championships, which I'm sure you all have been watching. It's a black Yorkshire, sort of spun half around in the colours of the World Championship bands. Yeah, it's a fantastic bit of trophy.
So this is a show about kit, and that is a nice bit of kit. How did you find the Harrogate event? Because to me, obviously, your events were on the Saturday, and they felt a little bit as though they were on the fringe of the event.
I think they were initially in the press. However, actually out there on the course, it was absolutely ridiculous. Like, the Sart towns were absolutely packed. So there was crowds all over the warm-up areas and all the way along the entire route. So if, I don't know if you guys are aware, there was three routes, one started in Beverley, one started in Tadcaster, even, and one started in Wetherby. So Beverley, Tadcaster, Wetherby. All the towns were just packed. All the start towns, at the start, was three or four people deep, all the way around the course, even like lay-bys and lane ends. Saying to you before we even start this interview, there's a small lane ending onto a big road with some barriers. End of that barrier, there's 40 or 50 people, 3 miles outside of Wetherby. It was absolutely insane. And then coming through Harrogate itself, I think it helped. We had really good weather. That was a really big positive. But there was four or five people deep all the way up the final 300-400 metres of Parliament Street heading to the finish, and all the way around the final sort of K and a half, 2K. The barriers were packed, people banging on the hoardings, screaming GB, screaming GB. It was literally the best experience of a race I've ever had.
So, I mean, we talk about how strong GB are, and I get this is a podcast about equipment and about the tech behind cycling. I've seen some of I've drafted behind some of the bikes you're riding. Is the success of GB a lot down to the kit you're provided with, and what sort of kit are you given?
Yeah, very much so. So we're sponsored by Cervelo. So GB, it all comes under one entire umbrella. So the Academy, Para and the Elite, they're all under one umbrella. So we're all stationed at the Velodrome in Manchester. So we're on Cervelos at the moment. So we're currently on the rim brake versions, but into the new year, we're all shifting across to disc brakes, which is really exciting. We'll come back to it later about tech and sort of adaptions. It's really exciting for some of the categories, what we can do with disc brakes. And the kit, the Callis general speed suit is really good. And then obviously it comes down to games. We get all the Olympic kit dropped on us, which is, for me, as a bit of a tech head, incredibly exciting.
So beyond the bike that you're riding, I mean, I think one of the reasons I wanted to do this interview is because when we were out on a ride the other day, you were telling me about one of the most important bits of kit that you have, and that's the... I mean, we haven't even talked about your disability, actually, and how it manifests itself. So first of all, tell us what your disability is.
Okay, so I am a men's C3, so I have a weakness to both of my legs, effectively. When I was 14, I caught a disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which took me about 2 years to recover from. I was quite seriously ill. I was in hospital for 4 months, and I came out of there. I was in a wheelchair for 9 months. I had to learn to walk again on crutches for 18 months. So I've been left with, effectively, going back a little bit. When I was in hospital, I was paralysed for a couple of days. So Guillain-Barré syndrome is a neurological disorder whereby your immune system turns on your nervous system and sort of destroys it from the extremities towards your core. So it can get, it's pretty serious. So I had quite a severe type of it. And it destroyed my nerve cores sort of back to the centre of my body. So as I was saying, it took me quite a long time to recover. And I've been left with residual weakness from sort of my knees downwards. So I don't have any use of my calves. I can't use my feet. I don't really have any blood flow, circulation or sensation below my knees. I've got a slight little bit of weakness in my hands, but that's not really any problem. So the main thing is I don't have any use of my calves, which are quite useful in cycling.
So we were talking about one of the important pieces of kit that you have, which is your adaptation. So tell us about your adaptation and how it helps you and how important it is.
Yeah, so the adaptation is known as an AFO, an ankle foot orthotic. Effectively, it's just a big piece of carbon fibre that wraps under my foot, is bolted into my shoe, that comes at the back of my calf. So prior to this, when I was pedalling, I was losing quite a lot of power because I can't use my calves. I was losing quite a lot of power and quite a lot of stability at the bottom of the pedal stroke because I basically had no resistance. Most people listen to this, when you pedal, your calf obviously locks out the bottom of your pedal stroke. And
a lot of people probably don't even know that that's happening.
Yeah, well, I never did before. When I rode a bike before being ill, I never even thought about it. So yeah, it basically, this stiffens up my ankle effectively and allows me to transfer power more effectively and smoother and more smoothly.
But one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, obviously this episode is about sort of design bias, and you know, the world is designed for able-bodied men, essentially. That's the theory. Yourself, your disability is quite hidden, really. In terms of accessibility to the sport, and you know, just going into a bike shop, you must face certain accessibility issues.
Yeah, I would agree myself, less so, and it's very dependent on your disability. But as you highlighted, some of the other members of the squad, be if you have sort of an arm impairment, say you sort of similar to Sarah Story or Crystal Lane, who's another women's C5, both highly competitive in the world of cycling, both able-bodied and para, but obviously they can't grip or hold onto a handlebar. So that adds not only a grip issue, also you can't use your left brake. So they have to have a brake splitter to allow it to control both brakes. Obviously, you can't brake quite as well. Guys who are missing arms or legs, you have adaptions. You have guys who are one-legged who ride single-legged and have a stump in a holder. I think once you get into parasport, I think there's loads and loads of adaptions. But I think if you're coming from an external side and you're like, right, I have this issue, I think unless you're quite lucky and you find somebody who happens to know somebody or you've seen paracycling on the TV, I don't think you're very aware about what adaptions there are around to allow you to, yeah, get into the great sport that is cycling.
I mean, you're talking about you've got a housemate who also rides for GB, and his experience, he has cerebral palsy. That's right, isn't it? So what's it? I mean, you know, for someone like that, obviously you can't speak for everyone, but you know, just going into a bike shop and trying to find the kit for yourself must be extremely difficult.
Yeah, for myself, I don't have any full adaptions, but I do, and I don't think it's something I truly think about that much. However, yeah, for say, I think Louis, who's hemiplegic, so he's affected down one side of his body. He has a brake splitter. His legs are different lengths. He has control issues moving from the tops to the drops. And obviously, well, his visibility is quite visible compared to mine. We'd have to get him on the podcast and get his full opinions and just, yeah, see what he thinks. But from chats we've had, yeah, definitely, it's little adaptions here and there that you can't see on the bike, but they do make a huge difference. So with Louis, I know he rides different length cranks. He rides a brake splitter. DI2 is a great invention because it allows him to have all his controls on the left-hand side, and he's now even moving to synchro shift. So yeah, he just needs one set of shift levers, so he doesn't have to try and shift with two. Matty, another rider on the program, I know he's come off whilst trying to change gears before, just because he has a similar disability and went to shift on effectively a bar end shifter on the bottom of his drops and missed it, and then unfortunately had a bit of a tumble at low speed, but it was okay. But yeah, the modern cycling has got so many more adaptions and new tech that is really helping parasport.
So I think actually there's a whole episode in adaptations and paracycling and accessibility, because it is fascinating. But you spent about half a season riding for Sarah Story's team.
Yeah, in 2017, I think. I was with Story Racing, with Sarah Story's and Barney Story's team. And Sarah's an incredible athlete. Oh, you know, the most decorated Paralympian of all time. And seeing the way that she handled her disability and the adaptations to her bike and how she just dealt with all this adversity on a bike.
What does she have as an adaptation?
So she has somewhere to put her right hand. It's a kind of, how would I describe it? It's like a round extra bit of handlebar that sits on top of your handlebar. And she puts her right arm into that. And then her left, with her left hand, she then has to have her brakes purely on the left side. So Barney's an incredible mechanic, and he has made this brake splitter. So both the front and rear brake come from that. But what's really interesting is when you brake on Sarah's bike, to somebody who uses, in inverted commas, normal brakes, it feels terrifying. And it really lacks the power that a kind of normal two-handed rim brake has. So I was actually talking about this with my husband last night, and we were thinking about the kind of how disc brakes are coming in. And I think that's something that in the future could be really beneficial to Sarah, actually, because the power that she would get from one squeeze of a disc brake could be a hell of a lot more than one squeeze of rim brake. But also you have the problem with her brake splitter that Barney has to put a slight delay on one of the brakes so that she doesn't just flip over the handlebars whenever she pulls the brakes on. But yeah, it's amazing. amazing the way she handles it and copes with it, and, you know, her technical skill with this adaptation and with the lack of braking power that she has.
Well, that's it for Service Course this week. Lizzie Banks, thanks for joining me. It's been amazing. Do you know, I've never been for a bike ride with a World Tour Pro before, so that's pretty special for me.
The first time for everything.
Any other business, I wanted to... A recent dilemma or a recent issue that crops up with the cycling podcast was to do with scones and cream or jam first. We have been sat here in the cafe in Tideswell having scones. And are we any clearer on the issue?
Yeah, so I brought Tom to High Nelly's Cafe in Tideswell, which is one of the best spots in the Peak District. And we sat down, had our scones, and then he promptly went and put cream on his scone first. And I looked at him in horror, you know, what on earth are you doing? And then no sooner did he start to put the cream on the scone before the jam, but the scone fell apart into four pieces. So I think it was clear from this encounter that you should put the jam on first.
There you go, Lionel. Jam first. Solved. Thank you very much, Lizzie. By the way, where are you next? Where are you off to?
Well, I'm off to Italy this weekend for a couple of races, and then I'm a sucker for punishment. So I actually entered Mamnik Hill Climb in 2 weekends' time. It's where I came from, and I thought, you know, I've got a free weekend. It's before my last weekend of racing. I should still have a bit of form. It'll be fun. I'm not sure if it'll be fun, but we're going to go anyway and maybe do a bit of a thing on hill climbing, and we'll bring that to you soon.
Yeah, we're off to go and drill through all our components in a shed somewhere, I think.